This 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Islamic insurgents advancing toward Baghdad, and Pakistan condemns U.S. drone strikes. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. Islamic insurgents have advanced toward Baghdad after seizing control of more territory just 90 kilometers north of the Iraqi capital. In lightning-quick strikes in recent days, fighters from the Sunni Muslim Islamic State of Iraq and Levant have captured most of the northern reaches of the country. A spokesman for the rebels, who are seeking to install an Islamic government, vowed they would push into Baghdad and on to Karbala, a city southwest of Baghdad that is one of the holiest sites for Shiite Muslims. U.S. President Barack Obama, who ended the nine-year war in Iraq in 2011, says Iraq would need more U.S. help and no options have been ruled out.
What we've seen over the last couple of days indicates the degree to which Iraq's going to need more help. It's going to need more help from us, and it's going to need more help from the international community. So my team is working around the clock to identify how we can provide the most effective assistance to them. I don't rule out anything because we do have a stake in making sure that these jihadists are not getting a permanent foothold in either Iraq or Syria, for that matter.
Follow this developing story at voanews.com. Two U.S. drone strikes have struck Pakistan's volatile North Waziristan tribal territory right on the Afghan border, killing at least 16 suspected militants. Ayaz Gul filed this report from Islamabad.
Residents and local intelligence officials report the first drone attack targeted a vehicle and a militant compound near Miran Shah, the administrative center of the Pakistan tribal district. Foreigners are said to be among up to 6 people killed in the raid, and some of them belong to the Haqqani network that is fighting alongside the Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan. Hours later, a drone fired missiles in the same area that reportedly killed at least 10 suspected militants. The two incidents provoked a swift condemnation by the Pakistani government. In a written statement, the Foreign Ministry spokeswoman described the strikes as a violation of Pakistan's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The U.S. Army sergeant held by the Taliban in Afghanistan for nearly 5 years is set to return to the United States. U.S. military officials say Bo Bergdahl, who's been treated at a military hospital in Germany, will arrive today at an Army medical center in the southwestern city of San Antonio, Texas. The 28-year-old Bergdahl won his freedom 2 weeks ago when U.S. President Barack Obama agreed to a prisoner swap, releasing 5 suspected Taliban terrorists from the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and sending them to Qatar, which agreed to keep them for a year. Pro-Russian separatists in the eastern Ukraine city of Donetsk say a van used by separatist rebel leader Denis Pushilin exploded Thursday in the central city, injuring at least 3 bodyguards. Rebel said Pushilin, one of the leaders of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, was not in the vehicle when the blast occurred in front of a separatist-occupied building. Also on Thursday, Ukraine's interior minister Arsen Avakov accused Russia of allowing an armored column, including 3 military tanks, to cross into Ukraine at a border control point manned by separatists. Russia did not immediately respond to the accusation. Brazil has made a first step towards winning the World Cup, as is hugely expected, but the host country needed a bit of help from the referees after falling behind 1-0 to heavy underdog Croatia in the 11th minute. Brazil recovered to win 3-1 in the opening game of the World Cup Thursday at the Arena Corinthians in Sao Paulo. Brazil's Group A match against Croatia was the only game Thursday. Today, Mexico and Cameroon clash in Total in another Group A game, while defending champion Spain plays the Netherlands and Salvador, and Chile faces Argentina in Group B matchups. Spain beat Netherlands 1-0 in the 2010 World Cup Championship. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The ICC says it has found enough evidence to try former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo.
The ICC is going to charge Laurent Gbagbo, the former president of Ivory Coast, with four charges of crimes against humanity, basically for his role in the murder, rape, and other inhumane acts that were committed during the post-election crisis in 2010 and 2011.
Paramprit Singh is a senior counsel with Human Rights Watch. The United Nations launches a two-year multi-million dollar appeal for drought relief in Djibouti. A spokesman for former Malawi President Joyce Banda denies she refused to hand over power to her successor. And South Sudan says four alleged coup plotters have decided to return to the ruling SPLM.
When they met the president, they expressed their intention to be working together with the president because they say they cannot leave SPLM. And president has welcomed them.
Atene Wak Atene is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. A Zimbabwe court has ruled that criminalizing defamation is unconstitutional, and the Football World Cup has begun in Brazil amid protests. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Judges at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, say former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo will stand trial on charges of crimes against humanity. The court's pre-trial chamber on Thursday said it found substantial grounds to believe Gbagbo is responsible for acts of murder, rape, and other crimes committed in Ivory Coast between December 2010 and April 2011. Gbagbo, who has been in ICC custody since 2011, has accused the court of acting on behalf of current President Alassane Ouattara. Paramprit Singh is a senior counsel at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She tells me her group is also looking forward to the day when the ICC will bring charges against Ouattara supporters who might have also committed crimes against humanity during the same period.
The ICC is going to charge Laurent Gbagbo, the former president of Ivory Coast, with four charges of crimes against humanity, basically for his role in the murder, rape, and other inhumane acts and persecution that were committed during the post-election crisis in 2010 and 2011.
So, I mean, where did they finally find these charges? It took a long time now. You know, people were wondering, if you can't find the charges, release him.
Basically what had happened, I mean, these were always the charges that were lodged against Gbagbo since the time of his arrest in November 2011. He had a confirmation of charges hearing. So basically the prosecution and the defense both presented information to the court to decide whether or not there was enough evidence there to commit the case to trial. And that hearing happened last February. And then last June, the judges came back and said, look, we don't think that there's sufficient evidence here to commit the case to trial, but we also think there's enough to potentially bring a case forward. So they adjourned the hearing. They gave the prosecution an extra 6 months and said, look, we need more forensic evidence. We need more hard evidence to show us that your case can be proved at trial. So they gave the prosecution 6 months. They gave them, you know, a couple of areas that needed further investigation. And the prosecution then did additional investigations. And then earlier this year, in January, they filed what's called an amended document containing the charges. So basically, it was an updated narrative of their case. A majority of the judges decided that it was enough. They finally had enough evidence to move the case to trial.
Of course, you know, the former President Gbagbo has always said that the charges against him were kind of frivolous, that he thought they took him out of Ivory Coast just to make way for Alassane Ouattara to take over. So the question I've always asked people is this. There are those who say there were crimes committed on both sides of this conflict in Ivory Coast. What's the view of your organization like Human Rights Watch in terms of the fairness, in terms of investigating or punishing people from the other side?
First of all, I just want to clarify, the fact that Gbagbo's case will move to trial doesn't mean that he's guilty. It just means that the judges believe there's enough evidence to move forward to the next step. With respect to crimes committed by the Ouattara side, I mean, Human Rights Watch, you know, as an organization, we've documented possible crimes against humanity that we believe can be attributed to the Ouattara side. And we have been pressing the ICC to open an investigation on the Ouattara side. We've also been pressing the national authorities. The Ivorian authorities have said time and again that their courts are up and running, their justice system is functioning once again. And to that, I would say that's great. We look forward to cases against, you know, those who supported Ouattara during the post-election crisis who were implicated in grave abuses.
Paramprit Singh is a senior counsel at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with me from New York. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir has accepted to work with four of the political detainees accused of plotting to overthrow his government after they decided to return to the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, the SPLM. The detainees include Pagan Amum, former Secretary General of the SPLM. Presidential spokesman Atene Wek Atene tells reporter Peter Clotty that President Kiir's decision to work with his political foes means he has demonstrated his commitment to resolve the country's ongoing conflict and ensure peace and stability.
The president said he was going to Ethiopia. He found the request from the four gentlemen of the seven detainees who were actually released on bail on the Kenya custody and requested to see the president. And these are four people, Kostina Nidi, John Luke, Bengalor, and Paganamon. These are senior SPLM officials. When they met the president, they expressed their intentions to be working together with the president because they say they cannot leave SPLM, so they wanted to be part of the SPLM. And the president has welcomed them and has been asked them to come with them because they say they wanted to come back to Juba. And the president has welcomed them and told them to come even immediately with him because the presidential plane that the president was using had a lot of space that would have even taken them. But they say there are certain things they wanted to sort out and they are coming back to Juba.
Has the president decided which position to give them in his administration?
The president has not decided to give them anything. First of all, these are the people who have been accused for attempting to overthrow the government. As you know, the president is one of the people that looks very much into how to keep this country united. So when these people offer, you know, that they are actually to come back and work with him as SPLM members to bring peace to South Sudan, the president accepted that because they are coming to work for peace and then work for reconciliation before they could look for any position. Because now it is the people of South Sudan to decide on which position of the former detainees could have.
Some people are speculating that this is just a facade and that there was no coup and this was just a charade. What do you say to that?
My brother, I always question the intelligence of those who think that coup did not take place in Juba. I always ask questions as to what has happened exactly on the 15th of December. The details that we are actually following from those who assume they know the situation in South Sudan were on the basis that it was the disarmament that, you know, the Dinka members of the Presidential Guard were trying to disarm the mere, you know, members of the Presidential Guard, which is a very big lie. And those who say that, I have every reason to question their intelligence, simply because the mere members within the Presidential Guard were more than the members of the Dinka Presidential Guard before the 15th of December 2013. It doesn't go very well for anybody who is sober to say that 800 people can go on a mission of disarming 1,500 a night.
Atene Wek Atene is South Sudan's presidential spokesman. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Juba. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 13th. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. The United Nations has launched a two-year multi-million dollar appeal to help 250,000 people in the tiny East African country of Djibouti recover from several years of persistent drought. The UN is seeking $74 million for 2014 to break out of the country's ongoing cycle of crises. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
2 weeks ago, two Somali suicide bombers blew themselves up along with a Turkish man in a cafe frequented by foreigners in Djibouti's capital city. The international media devoted little coverage to the story, underlining how overlooked and neglected this tiny country in the Horn of Africa is by the rest of the world. This is a major problem for nearly one quarter of Djibouti's population of 850,000. Some 250,000 people who are seriously affected by more than 4 years of consecutive drought. UN resident coordinator in Djibouti, Robert Watkins, is in Geneva to get international donors to pay attention to their plight and to support plans to help them emerge from this crisis. He says malnutrition rates have increased to 18%, which exceeds the emergency threshold of 15%. In some areas, he says, malnutrition is as high as 26%, and the rate of chronic malnutrition is 30%.
It's still a very traditional nomadic population, and the livestock has been very dramatically affected by the drought, with stocks continuing to go down. It's a drought deficit that has accumulated over the last 4 years, and it's also resulting in huge exodus of people living in the rural areas to the capital city. The population has almost tripled in the capital city. Now 85% of the population is now living in the capital cities.
Watkins says the city's facilities are overwhelmed by this huge rural influx, as well as by the large numbers of mainly Ethiopian migrants that transit through Djibouti on their way to Yemen. Most of the migrants use Yemen as a portal to reach other countries in the Middle East. Last year, about 100,000 migrants arrived in Djibouti. Watkins says many of them are in desperate condition and in need of medical care. The two-year strategic plan goes beyond food and healthcare humanitarian projects. He says it deals with more developmental projects. The aim is to address the root causes so people will be better equipped to tackle the effects of drought.
The biggest issue facing Djibouti today is the lack of water. People depend on water for their livelihoods, essentially for their livestock. So we're doing a lot of projects and so that there is less waste of water.
Nearly half of Djibouti's population is unemployed. Watkins says the strategic plan will try to address this problem in various ways. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The spokesman for former Malawi President Joyce Banda is denying reports that she refused to officially hand over power to newly elected President Peter Mutharika during last week's installation ceremony in the commercial capital, Blantyre. Tusekele Mwanyongo tells reporter Peter Clotty that the former president could not travel from the capital Lilongwe to Blantyre because authorities took away her convoy that would have enabled her to make the trip to the ceremony.
The former president, Her Excellency Dr. Joyce Banda, did not refuse to officially hand over power to the new president, His Excellency Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika. I think the point is that the former president, Her Excellency Dr. Joyce Banda, had her official presidential convoy withdrawn the very first morning that the results were announced. In fact, she was in Lilongwe. The inauguration ceremony was happening in Blantyre.
What is she doing now following the loss?
Her Excellency Dr. Joyce Banda is resting. She had quite a hectic time campaigning in the elections. She traveled all over trying to campaign and win the elections. And she never lost, but I think she's resting. I mean,
President Arthur Mutharika said he is willing to meet former President Joyce Banda as part of a reconciliation effort to unite the country. Is she available to meet?
I don't think that Her Excellency Dr. Joyce Banda would refuse to meet the new president, His Excellency Professor Arthur Mutharika, if they need to. But if it means meeting the new president because there has to be reconciliation or whatsoever, I don't think that should be the reason for any such kind of a meeting, because there's never been a conflict. You know, there had been an election. And when that election ended, the courts declared that the results have to be announced. And the results were announced. And the former president, Her Excellency Dr. Joyce Banda, accepted that declaration by the Malawi Electoral Commission that His Excellency Professor Arthur Mutharika had won the elections. She did make an official announcement to say she had accepted that kind of a declaration that Professor Arthur Mutharika had been declared the winner of the elections, and then that the country has to move on for the sake of unity, for the sake of progress and development.
Tusekele Mwanyongo is the spokesman for former Malawi President Joyce Banda. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. The Zimbabwe Constitutional Court ruled on Thursday that criminalizing defamation is unconstitutional, saying the law should be scrapped because it violates freedom of expression. Two journalists who were working for the Standard newspaper petitioned the court after they were charged with defaming Muyarazi Kiriki in a criminal fashion. The paper had published a story alleging that Kiriki's Green Card Medical Aid Society was facing financial hardships and failing to pay its employees. Journalist Nkaba Mashazi tells Viewers Zimbabwe program he's happy with the court's ruling.
Having a case hanging over your head for 3 years is a bit tricky, and it's quite thrilling and exciting that the law should be struck off as it is deemed unconstitutional. So I'm over the moon. I'm excited.
What does this mean for press freedom in Zimbabwe?
Well, the judgment is not yet quite final because the Minister of Justice has been called upon, if he has any issues, to come to the court and say if he has any issues to having the law struck down. But just in case it doesn't, and if the judgment is upheld, it will mean a very lot to journalists. For the past 5-10 years, several journalists have been arrested for criminal defamation. I can count 10 probably at the top of my head. And criminal defamation, by its nature, meant that the burden of proof is on the accused rather than on the state. So chances of you being found guilty are much higher because you have to prove you're not guilty rather than prove you're innocent. So it's coming at a good time because in the past we've seen people being arrested on the flimsiest of charges, and also there's been a tendency by probably some of us in the media to censor ourselves because we don't know whose toes we're stepping on, and the use of criminal defamation is a bit of a catch-all law. So probably exciting times. It's not the end of it all. The fight for freedom of expression should continue, but this is a beginning to say at least this thing has been removed out of our way, this law, this kind of legislation, and to somewhat it frees the journalist fraternity.
Nkaba Mashazi is a former journalist with the Zimbabwe Standard Times newspaper. He was speaking with Untungamile Nkomo of VOA's Zimbabwe program. The Football World Cup began Thursday with host country Brazil winning its opening game against Croatia with a score of 3-1. But as we hear from VOA sports reporter Scott Barb in Rio de Janeiro, opening day was marred by protests against the tournament.
Downtown at Rio de Janeiro's famed Candelaria Church, two members of the Black Bloc protest group, going by the names Rocky and Nika, say the government, instead of spending $11 billion on football, should have focused on social services.
Social equality, investment in education and health and public services.
School teacher Valeria Matush says Brazil's education system has deteriorated in recent years.
We demand improvement in our school system. We denounce the diversion of funds from education and culture that were meant for our work and our school materials.
Police in Sao Paulo, ahead of the opening World Cup match there, used tear gas to disperse a similar demonstration by protesters. The protesters say cronyism and corruption permeate Brazilian government. Here in Rio, a member of the Communist Party, Carlos Serrano, says many favelas and neighborhoods were destroyed for the World Cup. He says this shows that the cup is against the people, not for the people.
Brazil!
This is absolutely absurd, and it's why we're having this mobilization. We're going to continue until the end of the cup, and in Rio de Janeiro, beyond the cup until 2016, when we have the Olympics, which is a replica of the same logic.
The number of demonstrators has declined as football fever grips the nation, but the activists say they will carry on until things change in Brazil.
It's 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa. Here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we focus on the FIFA World Cup in Brazil.
Striker Neymar da Silva Santos Jr., more commonly known simply as Neymar, struck the back of the neck twice, while Oscar dos Santos Emboaba Jr., or simply Oscar, added a third goal as hosts Brazil bounced back from an own goal setback to beat Croatia 3-1 in a thrilling tournament opener in Sao Paulo on Thursday. Staying in Sao Paulo, Sierra Leone's Football Association President Isha Johansson received a standing ovation at the FIFA Congress when FIFA President Sepp Blatter acknowledged she is the only female in the world currently heading a national football federation. Johansson is the third female national federation head after Liberia's Izet Sombo-Wesley and Burundi's Lydia Nsereka. Among FIFA's 209 members, Africa stands out as the only place in the world to have had a female head of a national federation. Meanwhile, today Friday, African fans get to cheer their first of five teams representing the continent at the World Cup. Cameroon's captain and four-time Africa Player of the Year, Samuel Eto'o, leads the indomitable Lions onto the pitch against Mexico in a Group A tie in Natal on the northeast coast of Brazil. Later, attention shifts to Group B, where defending champions Spain play the Netherlands in Salvador, northeast Brazil, before Chile and Australia clash in Cuiabá in central Brazil. Elsewhere, fans are in for a bumper treat tomorrow Saturday. Colombia play Greece in Belo Horizonte before Uruguay and Costa Rica clash in Fortaleza. Then England and Italy engage in the heart of the Amazon tropical forest in the city of Mananas before at the Ivory Coast encounter Japan in Recife. On Sunday, Switzerland play Ecuador in Brasilia. France engage Honduras in Porto Alegre as Argentina and Bosnia-Herzegovina clash in Rio de Janeiro. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday. Our listener mail for this Friday morning comes from Umiakuka Maurice of the Federal Polytechnic in Oko, Anambra State, Nigeria. He says, "Dear VOA, please permit me to use this medium to air my view on the pension law recently passed by the Akwa Ibom House of Assembly. It is quite absurd that a governor who has been in office for just 4 years will get a pension to the tune of hundreds of millions of naira. Yet after his tenure, the same governor could still proceed to the Senate or be appointed a minister while still enjoying the pension." Well, thank you, Umiakuka Maurice of the Federal Polytechnic in Oko, Anambra State, Nigeria, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Judges at the International Criminal Court said former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo will stand trial on charges of crimes against humanity. The court's pre-trial chamber said it found substantial grounds to believe Gbagbo is responsible for acts of murder, rape, and other crimes committed in Ivory Coast between December 2010 and April 2011. Gunfire erupted for a second day Thursday on the border between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Reports from the area say soldiers exchanged fire briefly on Thursday morning in a town north of Goma, the capital of Congo's North Kivu province. Each side has accused the other of provoking the clashes. And that's it for this Friday, June 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing everybody in Africa a very good weekend.
Do you love African music?
Music time in Africa. Wake, wake, wake,
wake, wake, umaru, wake. This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000, and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.
From Washington, this is...